So from the list of all those things that you've just said, like sleep deprivation and obviously the distance and nutrition, what would you say was the single most hardest part of the challenge, if there is a single most hardest part of the challenge?
Water quality, which was absolutely disgraceful. Thanks to Thames Water, assuming that the Thames is an open sewer, and deciding just to dump sewage into the river whenever they feel like it, principally because I was informed that the fine for dumping is cheaper than treating the water.
Welcome to the Propulsion Swimming Podcast, where we aim to give swimming the coverage and publicity it deserves. Every week, we celebrate the sport we love with amazing special guests and topics from around the swimming pool. And now, here are your hosts, Scott and Dan.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott, and back with me, as always, is my good friend, Dan. Now, over the course of this summer, many of the British swimming elite were pushing their bodies through never-seen-before fatigue, competing in three major championships. However, our guest this week potentially outdid them all with a swim a little bit closer to home on the River Thames.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we will always take our hats off to people who take part in such amazing physical challenges in the effort to raise money for much needed causes. And our guest does just that and deserves all the credit and praise in the world.
Definitely. So today's guest is quite possibly a little bit of British sporting royalty. He has coached 36 sport and comic relief and children in need challenges to raise over £60 million for charity, including David Walliams's 8-day swim of the River Thames in 2012. He calls himself an ultra endurance nutter. He's a former Olympian in modern pentathlon and is a European and world medalist. And that man is, of course, Greg White, OBE. Greg, thank you so much for coming on to this podcast. How are you?
Well, listen, I'm great, and thank you for having me on. That was a mouthful. You got through that, which was great. You know?
Just about. There's so much that we are going to talk through on this week's podcast. We're, of course, going to chat through your incredible challenge, taking part earlier on this summer through the Thames for two incredibly important charities in this country. We'll touch upon European Masters a little bit, because you are a guest who obviously competed there in Rome, and then a little bit of Training the Stars as well, because there's a bit of a resume to who you've coached.
Yeah, there's a few.
So let's kick things off with a challenge, a Guinness World Record attempt at a 125-mile swim of the Upper Thames in 4 days. I'm going to start with the obvious question. How was it? How much did that hurt?
It was brutal. I mean, it's a war of attrition is the only way to describe it, really. And I think, it's one of those challenges, an interesting one, because it's... there's so many factors on big sort of ultra challenges like that. There are so many factors that influence the outcome. Notwithstanding things like the flow of the river, which was, as described by the Environment Agency, a trickle.
Really? Wow.
It was incredible, actually. What the Environment Agency had done is they'd actually closed all the sluice gates at all of the, there's 43 locks that you have to go through, or you have to go around. They'd opened all, closed all the sluice gates to try and preserve the water. And I spoke to the team there, and they said that if they opened the sluice gates, the river would actually run dry. There was so little water. So that was an interesting one, because normally anybody who swam in the Thames or any river, knows that when you've got the flow with you, it really does make a difference. If nothing else, it makes you feel like a superstar when you're moving along.
Did that add to the challenge, the fact that you had to get in and get out all the time?
Yeah. I mean, it does, and certainly I think it was sort of articulated to me. People who were following it on socials and that, it was. At each of the locks, you're not allowed to go through the locks. So you have to portage around it, and that means you have to climb steps. Some of the big sections were up to 5 hours of swimming between locks, and then just changing body position into upright position, then actually using your arms to try and drag yourself out of the water. I mean, and if you watch me getting out, I got out like a man who needed some assistance. And it was, but equally at the same time, what it does do is actually breaks it up really quite nicely. So that, that whole idea of sort of setting short-term goals when you're taking on these big challenges, they're sort of preset by the locks and the distances between the locks. But it's it helps and also it hinders. It's just one of those things.
Well, my first obvious question would be why do this challenge? what was the reason for this specific challenge?
Well, you know, it's a great question. It's a question my wife asked me on a continual basis. I think what it was, throughout the pandemic, I'm a board member of UK Active, who saw the government lobby group and the industry representative of the health and fitness industry. And I sort of have a real passion, a real love for swimming and a real focus on swimming. And one of the things that I picked up during that period of time was the absolute absence of swimming availability. I worked incredibly closely with UK Active and with Sage and government to get the sector reopened, and crucially to get swimming pools reopened. Because what happened during that period is that 1 million children missed out on swimming lessons. Mm-hmm. And it led to what is a disgraceful position, in my opinion, and that is that 2 million children left primary school this year unable to swim, despite it being a requirement of the national curriculum for them to be able to swim by year six, so 11 years of age. So we had that. Add on top of that, I live by the river and by the Thames itself, and the number of drownings that occur in this country, one person drowns every 20 hours, and which, you know, is an absolute tragedy. Many of those are preventable, and then sort of the layer on top of that is that actually the Royal Life Saving Society do an incredible job around water safety and drowning prevention, and the Royal National Lifeboat Institute, both fundamentally rely, their third sector, their charities, they rely upon income generated from people who take on various different challenges or from the public who donate to them. So to some extent, it was the perfect storm for me, that I felt it was absolutely the right time to take on a big swimming challenge and really focus the efforts. The effort was obviously to swim it, but actually, to my mind, the success of the challenge itself was actually about raising the profile of drowning prevention, number one. And secondly, was to raise as much money as we possibly could for both of those incredible charities. And you know, I'm absolutely delighted and proud to say that we sort of ticked both of those boxes, which was really important to me.
It's interesting. Do you think endurance challenges are the best way to almost get that exposure? Because you're obviously not the first person to do extreme long distance swims, and you've coached several people to do it as well. Do you think that's almost a necessity to get the exposure that's desired?
No is the answer to that, and I really don't think it is that way. And actually, what's interesting about it is that, you know, and my experience with, you know, as you said, 36 Common Relief, Sport Relief, and Children in Need charities, the general public have got a concentration period that they can focus on the challenge. And what we found through those challenges is that once you move beyond a certain distance. Or a certain time period, actually you start to lose traction and you have to work incredibly hard. So, you know, for example, I work with Eddie Izzard, and his 53 marathons, 51 marathons in 43 days. You know, an incredible feat, but it's interesting how it sort of perturbates in terms of interest because trying to get traction. I think the crucial element is, and the one thing I focused really hard on, was that I had a good friend of mine, a guy called Mark Woods, who was the former head of social media for Comic Relief. He came on the challenge for me. And the guy is a wizard, an absolute genius when it comes to social media and his ability. What we saw in that period, within the first 3 days, we had over 1 million impressions on social media. Now, to me, that's the mark of success of a project where you're looking to raise the profile of something, is actually how many people interact. It's not just about it being on social media. It's about people interacting with it. So I think in terms of what type of challenge do you need to do, I think to some extent the challenge is important because it's got to engage people and enable them to come in and think, oh, my God, you know, this is something I should definitely support. But I think, you know, second to that, it's about the team that you wrap around you to ensure that you are delivering the message, that you're getting the traction, that you've got the impressions, which then lead to the donations and that profile raising of the message of the challenge itself.
Yeah. And speaking of your team, how big was your team? I mean, the logistical planning must have taken quite a long time to do that sort of thing.
It was incredible. I mean, and the team were just absolutely fantastic. You know, and what I love about these challenges, so, you know, for me, I've done 36 challenges and I've, people call it work. I've never charged a single penny for that work, because it is what, you know, I see it as my contribution to those projects. And I think what's great about my team on this particular project is that everybody came on board and did it for free and contributed because they were part of the messaging, they part of what we were trying to achieve. And there were 14 of us. I mean, you know, it's a fairly big team. But then also what you have to think is that, you know, day one on the swim, for example, I swam 53 kilometres. We started at 9 a.m. and I finished at 1:30 a.m. the following morning. And so, we're going through the night. And so there's obviously a safety issue with that. There's also the fact that we've got support boats. They've got to be driven. We've also got stand-up paddle boards on water with me. We've got the fundraising team. And then we made a documentary with it. We've got the film team with it as well. So there's an awful lot of moving parts which require the commitment and dedication and hard work of an awful lot of people. And I was definitely fortunate enough to have an absolutely outstanding team on it.
That's a lot of kilometres in one day. That scares the life out of me. Yeah.
it's one of those crazy things that we, you know, as you guys know, we call the 10K a marathon. Mm. And you think it was 5.5 marathons in a day. And it's a weird psyche when you first get in. What you can't do is think, I've got 53 kilometers to go. You try and tick it off by the locks. But also in the back of my mind, sometimes I'm ticking it off. I often tick it off around 5K and 10K as a sort of that sort of marker as we're going through. But having done a marathon of 10K, you then have this realization that you've got another 4.5 of those to go. Yeah. it's crazy. But you know, hey, it's what makes the challenge, isn't it?
Oh, that would really hurt my mind trying to deal with that. So what kind of training did you have to do beforehand? Was it both obviously physically, but then did you have to sort yourself out mentally as well?
Well, do you know, it's an interesting question. A lot of people ask that around the sort of the challenge. So I think you know the key to success in any challenge fundamentally, but certainly any big sort of physical sporting challenge is the training. The training is everything. Mm-hmm. You know, the success is not a chance event. You can't just rock up and all of a sudden it'll happen. But I think part of that training, actually, what I always say is that constantly that any single session, when you dissect any single session, it's not just about the physiology. You're not just doing it to improve your swimming ability. Part of it is actually the psychology. So on a long swim, the big long swims in training, much of that is actually about, you know, what are the coping strategies and developing those coping strategies as you go along. And all of those then translate into the challenge itself. And of course, you've got on top of that, you've got technical, you've got tactical, you know, what are you going to feed? When are you going to feed? How are you going to feed it? And then obviously on a challenge like this, the complexity of actually bringing the rest of the team with you and making sure that the communication means that we're moving along as smoothly as possible. But it is, I mean, you know, there's no doubt about it. On a project like this, the mind is incredibly important in getting there, but it's the training that develops the mind. I think that's the key to it.
Yeah, I'm interested in little kind of key details in this. How did you cope with one, very little sleep if you've got to keep your mind sharp, and then two, kind of the nutrition side of it with so long in the water? How do you eat and how do you keep refueled?
Well, you know, I think sleep is one of the key ones. So in other challenges I've done previously, I've raced, we did the Race Across America cycle race from West Coast to East Coast, and we ran a research project alongside it. And in the final 2 days, I averaged 10 minutes sleep a day. And it's amazing. The hallucinations you have on such little on sleep deprivation is incredible. I mean, properly incredible.
I can, I've done an architecture degree. I can testify for that one.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you know, it's mad when you think about it. But obviously, the sort of serious note to that is actually, you know, on a bike, you're moving at high speed. The last thing you want to do is fall off. In the water, you know, actually making sure that you're communicating with the team to stay safe, absolutely critical, particularly with something like sleep deprivation, because it's disorientating. It's, you know, you get this sort of narcoleptic episodes where you fall asleep, even, you know, mid-activity. It's quite a strange feeling. But I think, you know, you do, again, it's those coping strategies that you develop in training. And for me, to some extent, that's where experience really does matter. I've done a whole host of 24-hour challenges with, particularly with Comet Relief and Children in Need, where we've done activity for 24 hours. And what you do is you create strategies to sort of cope with that. But sleep's an interesting one. And then nutrition is even more interesting. I mean, it does come down to calories to some extent. And it's sort of unadulterated, just calorie consumption whenever you can get it. But one of the key problems with that is that with sleep deprivation, with absolute fatigue and a constant motion, invariably it's really difficult to get food in, to get nutrition in. And of course, the other thing that we often forget is that when you're submerged in water, it's an interesting one, you know, when we're talking about swimming, is that people don't think that you dehydrate because you're surrounded by water. Yeah. And of course, actually, you know, you think about when my swim was, it was an extremely hot period. I was in a wetsuit. And you know, the water temperature wasn't, you know, certainly wasn't a problem at that time. And so you're dehydrating significantly. What that then does, that adds to issues around performance, but also cognitive function. And so making sure you keep on top of that all the time is absolutely crucial to success.
Were you in the wetsuit for the world record attempt, or was that purely your own preference?
No. I mean, you know, to some extent, it was sort of swings and roundabouts. I think the interesting thing is, and you've probably spoken to a host of people on this, I'm actually faster in skins. I did a race a couple of years ago as part of the Henley Swim, where you do it's skins versus suits. And I remember swimming the first swim, it's a mile, the first swim was in suits. And I can't remember what it was. I went sort of circa 18 minutes, something like that, for the first mile. And then you basically get out, walk back down in skins, so suits first, and you get back in skins. So pre-fatigued, you then go again. Mm. And I actually went quicker pre-fatigued in skins than I had done in suits. So to some extent, it wasn't about speed. I think going back to the issue of sleep deprivation and fatigue, one of the key problems with that is thermoregulation. I'm sure, you know, people listening will know that when you're really tired, the water always feels colder. Now extrapolate that to only having had 2 hours sleep and having done 53 kilometers on the first day, and you're getting back in at 4:30 in the morning in the pitch black, and you know, there is a chill in the air, and actually, you know, it's sort of coping, it's making sure that you can cope with the environment as it goes on. It's not about the first day, it's about the last day. And then I think finally, actually, there is an element of safety and security about it as well, is that actually in the wetsuit, not only am I controlling thermoregulation, so I'm making sure that I don't become hypothermic. I think crucially, it's the ability just to float if something does go wrong.
So from the list of all those things that you've just said, like sleep deprivation and obviously the distance and nutrition, what would you say was the single most hardest part of the challenge, if there is a single most hardest part of the challenge?
Water quality. Which was absolutely disgraceful. Thanks to Thames Water assuming that the Thames is an open sewer and deciding just to dump sewage into the river whenever they feel like it, principally because I was informed that the fine for dumping is cheaper than treating the water. And so, you know, I mean, it's not rocket science as to why they dump it, because it means they make more money. But honestly, I would say that was one of the critical problems. I tell you what, it's an interesting one. In my entire open water swimming career in wetsuits, etc., it is the first and only time I've ever had to use Dettol on my suits when I got back, because the stench of the suits was... the kids came to pick me up at the end. I put them in the boot, and halfway home, you've never heard so much complaining about the smell in the car. And it was like, what is that smell? And I said, that is what I've been swimming through for the past 4 days. You know?
So you're actively aware of this when you're swimming through it. Like it's very obvious.
You can smell it, you can taste it, and you can see it.
God. How many showers does it take for you to get rid of the smell?
Well, the irony is that I got my wetsuit out the other day, and all I can smell is Dettol now. Which, to be honest with you, I think it's worse than the stench it was before.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Blimey.
Horrible. It's certainly a topic that we want to cover a little bit more in the future, but I think you've just addressed it there. The simple answer is, until the fines get bigger, it's not going to stop.
Stay the same. Yeah.
Because money's king, really. Yeah. Unfortunately.
And I think that is the problem. And I think, we can talk about respect and respect for the environment, but sadly, money is king and money dictates. And their excuse would be that they're speaking to their shareholders. Well, to me, they have a moral obligation to ensure that what their company is all about, what water companies' job is water. And that should be all water. It shouldn't just be exclusively what comes out of the tap. And so I think that they have a moral and ethical obligation to ensure that what they do is that they treat water with the respect.
100%.
I mean, you'd think so, wouldn't you? Should we go back to a slightly lighter sort of tone?
Yeah, let's do it.
obviously, you're raising money, and you raise funds of, I believe, you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, over £20,000 for
over 30, which was nice.
For the charity. Over 30, and wow.
Yeah.
You've kind of said why you said those charities. Is there any sort of other charities that you'd also want to raise money for?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting one, because I've spent a sort of almost a life in and around charity. I used to be a chairman of a charity. My specialist area is tragically, my specialist area is sudden cardiac death in young athletes. And I was the chairman of a charity called Cardiac Risk in the Young for a number of years, and raised money for them. I'm now an ambassador for the Male Cancer Awareness Charity. And again, I think, some of these things, as you'll know, when you've got a personal affinity with it, my father and mother both died of cancer. And it's intriguing when you look at the provision for male cancer, which is almost a taboo subject until very recently. We don't like to talk about the fact that men have prostate cancer, testicular cancer, penis cancer. It was a taboo subject that nobody liked to talk about, and men are so awful at actually getting checked up and going to the doctor. If anybody's listening and is thinking about it, do it. Don't think about it, just do it. And those guys I run the London Marathon for, and done it, and we cycled London to Paris for, and so we've raised funds for them. So yeah, to me I love it. What do I get from it? I think I get an absolute, I love doing it, and I get a sense of satisfaction from doing it. And also, it's a wonderful way to challenge yourself, because once you're committed to raising money, I'm working with the British Heart Foundation this year, who are the charity of the London Marathon. And I always say to people, the first thing to do is tell everybody you're doing it and raise money for charity, and then the pressure is on.
All eyes on you.
But in a good way, in a good way. It keeps you out there.
Yeah, now we're talking... This challenge has been completed, obviously, but halfway through there was a scare moment. There was a pretty bad injury. How did that happen? Because it was a torn bicep, if I'm correct.
Yeah, so it's insertion of the bicep and a posterior delt issue. It's an interesting one. Yeah, how did it happen? I think it was just one of those things. I think that it was just an overuse issue. And very difficult to sort of look back. We filmed it, so we might actually get some idea once we take a look back at the footage and that. But there may well have been a single moment when it happened. But it, in my mind, what effectively what it did is just accrued. It started on day one. It just got worse and worse and worse and worse, to the point where actually the team, the medical team, were worried that I had ruptured the bicep tendon. Listen, it's one of those things. It wasn't ruptured. That was a bonus. We managed to finish the challenge, which is great. But yeah, I mean, if it was easy, everyone would do it, wouldn't they? So,
yeah. I mean, at what point did you realise that you just couldn't push through that pain anymore?
Well, intriguingly, I actually managed to get to Marlow. Marlow's my hometown. And to be fair, probably in the back of my mind, that was really a driving force to actually get to my hometown. But I got to Marlow, and at Marlow, that was 150,000 metres in. We were a long way in at that stage. But actually, it came to the point where effectively I actually just couldn't get my arm above the top of my head. And I'd already tried one arm. I tried a backstroke. I'd done all those things that we would all do. But it just got to the point where I just couldn't get the arm over the top of the head in whatever guise, breaststroke, backstroke, front crawl, and I wasn't going to try fly.
Probably a good
that
idea.
That would have been a mistake, you know. But yeah, you know, and so it got to the point where I needed to get it treated before we could continue on. So,
and there was never any doubt in your mind, just as soon as it's healed, back in the water, back finish the challenge.
You know, I felt compelled, and I think I felt compelled because from the beginning of July to, you know, which is sort of where I started the challenge, following 4 weeks, over 50 young people lost their lives to drowning. Yeah, I mean, it was just such a shocking period. It was during, everyone remember the heat wave. Mm. And I just felt compelled to actually, as much as anything, it wasn't a sort of personal thing that you know, I've got to finish it and get to the finish. But I think it was about perpetuating the message and continuing to raise funds for the charities, because it is such an important message and such important work that they do. Because, you know, many of these drownings are preventable, not all preventable, but many drownings are preventable. And I think it's incumbent upon us all to ensure that we can provide the right information and the right education. Water safety education is so important. It's not just about learning to swim. And so I felt compelled to carry on.
Yeah, and we've had both of those charities on this podcast. We'll link both our chats with both of the guests related to each in the show notes of this podcast for anyone who's interested. But you weren't done there for the summer. No resting on your laurels. Then you then decided to catch a plane, head over to Rome, and complete a European Masters. So the bicep is clearly all better. No nagging injuries. And you got to race at possibly one of the best pools in the world. I'll put that out there.
I'll tell you something. Do you know, funnily enough, I was talking about that today to my coach, who coaches the R Masters squad. I'm up at Wickham District Swimming Club. Mm. Fantastic squad. Fantastic performance squad, but actually a fantastic master squad. I love it. It was interesting. In my 50th year, I did 50 swims in my 50th year around the world, and somebody asked me what was the highlight of that 50th year, and it was the highlight for me was the fact that I actually joined the squad at the beginning of it, and it was actually being part of a team. I think, you know, it's one of those things, if you're listening and you love swimming and you feel a bit intimidated about sort of master squads and about joining a squad because it all sounds a bit too professional. Do you know what? It's one of the best things you can do is that shared misery of training, but also the shared success and the fun that you have and all that sort of, it was brilliant. So yeah. But I was chatting to my coach, who, interesting enough, he was at the World Junior Championships in Peru with one of the swimmers. Wow. And so didn't make it out to Rome. And he said to me, what was it like? And I said, that swimming pool is, I mean, it was just a treat. It was, you know, I said to the guys while we're out, I said, you know what, this is a privilege just to be able to swim in this pool where so many great swimmers and so many great times, but it is just an iconic pool, absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, well, how did you rate your own performances? Because you came away with silverware, bronze in the 200 meter freestyle. Was that a PB or close to?
Do you know what? I was still carrying the shoulder injury to some extent. I'd just come off 125 miles. And here I was in the pool trying to go, you know, 2:16 as it was. You know?
It's not the taper you're after, is it?
Yeah, no, that's right. You know, it's not the traditional way that you prepare for a 200 meters. But do you know what? I was absolutely... I mean, here's an interesting one, and it was interesting being a, you know, I'm sort of almost like the elder statesman of the squad to some extent, not necessarily because I'm the oldest, but because I've been around so long. And I just remember, you know, one of the guys who swam got a bronze. It was an event before I'd raced and got a bronze and was disappointed. And so I just sat with him and just had a chat with him. I said, look, you know, firstly, number one, did you give it 100%? Did you give it everything you've got? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, that's it. That's all you can do. That's all you can ask of anybody. When you, whatever it is we're doing in life, all you can do is give it 100%. And what it spills out the back of that, where you come, what time you did, etc., is to some extent an irrelevance. Or it's certainly not something that's within your gift to control. They've only got one thing that you can control, and that's give it 100%. And I think for me, you know, people say, you know, the question is, was I pleased with my performance? When I touched that wall at the end of 200, I had nothing left to give. It was I laid it all out there. And so, you know, to get a bronze, it wasn't a PB, but I was actually pleased with the time because of the backdrop of it. But more than anything else, listen, I gave it everything I had. If I'd have come fourth or 14th, it wouldn't have mattered because I had nothing else left. So, you know, you can only do what's in your gift to control, and that is just effort. And luckily and fortuitously ended in the bronze medal, which I was delighted with.
And that's a powerful message for anyone who's listening, whether it's club swimmers, master swimmers, coaches, parents. Essentially, that translates to every aspect of life, I would say. Master swimming internationally, obviously you have to cover the cost of yourself to go race in Rome. It's not funded by a governing body. Would you say that is something that master swimmers should invest in? Is it a bucket list lifetime experience?
I tell you the one thing. Interesting stuff. Yesterday, I swam the county championships, which I'm sure most of the masters, they all swim the county championships on the same day, and it's local pool, an awful lot cheaper than going to Rome for the European Masters. So I, the one thing I would say, I think it's important to race, and that is not going back to what we said before. It's not about racing to beat other people. I think it's actually about racing to ask yourself the question, what have you got? What is in you? And we were chatting about this yesterday, and the fact is that however hard you train, it's never racing. It's never competing. You've always find that extra gear. You always squeeze a little bit more out. And I think it's a wonderful personal challenge. And again, people are quite, uptight and, somewhat scared of racing and etc. Don't approach it like that. What you're approaching, this is a personal time trial in an event where there are an awful lot of other people doing a personal time trial. And again, where you come is irrelevant. What you're trying to do is gauge all that work you're putting into training, lay it out there. And I tell you what also happens off the back of that is that this sort of one mantra that I use with a lot of the guys that I work with is, to some extent, what you're doing is you're resetting your misery gauge. Is that in training, you think you're pushing hard and you think, you finish a hard set and you think, God, that was really, really tough. And then you go and race and you realize, oh no, that was training. This is how hard it can feel. And so that misery gauge, what you do is you elevate that misery gauge such that what you get off the back of that is you get a benefit into training, because now you go into training and you think you're working hard before, but now you know, actually, there's another gear in there. There's a bit more that you can squeeze out. You can actually push that little bit harder. So I think, it drops back into training and then it becomes sort of self-fulfilling. So next time you race, you'll go a bit quicker because you're training harder for longer, and it becomes self-fulfilling through it. But so when it comes to something like the Masters, like the European or World Masters, I think it's an interesting one because they are expensive trips. I mean, there's no getting around that. But I think, to some extent, they are life-affirming trips. I tell you what I loved. I arrived in Rome, and on the first day, some of our guys were swimming 100 breasts, so I went to the pool to support them. And I got there for heat number one was the 100 breast, and heat number one was the 90 to 95-year-olds.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, I'm in awe. I said to the guys, listen, why am I alive at that age? I'll be pleased. Never mind turning up, to this iconic pool in Rome and actually racing. These guys could hardly walk along the poolside, and yet there they were racing 100 metres. Just so inspiring. So for me, just to experience that, tells you, age is just a number. And what a fantastic thing to set your sights on. I'd love it. At 90 to 95, I would love to be racing at European Masters. Mm. What an accolade that would be. I think you got that. And then also, I think, they are, again, it brings us back to this idea of joining a squad. And I think if you join a squad, I think, again, it's that shared experience is absolutely brilliant, and you just don't get it anywhere else. It's really something very special. And also the way in which, it's funny, we were in a relay and it was brilliant. And it's like being an elite athlete, because they've got a cool room, you then wait in the cool room, and then you're brought out in lane order, and all of that sort of paraphernalia is part of it. And I sat in the cool room with these guys and I said to them, do you know what, this is what I love just here right now. That fear that adrenaline that rushes through you in the call room, where you know that in minutes' time you're going to be thrashing yourself as hard as you possibly can, giving everything that you've got. And I said, "What? You know, it's invigorating. What a way! You know, what a way that we, you don't get that in any. To my mind, you don't really get that in any other walk of life. It's just such a privilege to be part of that. So I think, yeah, it is expensive." But I think if you choose it wisely and you make sure that you make the most of it, I don't think you'll ever regret spending the money on it.
Yeah, that's a good thing about Masters. You can literally go all the way through for the rest of your life, as long as you're 18 plus, obviously, up to 95. Can you imagine doing that? I'm just not, like, people keep asking us, should we do nationals? Should we do Masters? But I'm just like, I'm not quite sure if I want to approach that misery gauge anymore, you know? So.
Do it. It's brilliant. It is great, though. It's a wonderful. But you're right. But what's interesting about it is the fear that sits before that. That doesn't change. It hasn't changed since I was an elite athlete to now. I stand behind those blocks and I've got the same fear rushing through me. Yeah. And do you know what? Does it matter where I come? You know what I mean? Nobody's watching me. Yeah. Nobody's paying me to do it. You know what I mean? I'm paying to do this. But the same fear grabs hold of you. And I just think it's a fantastic, a wonderful feeling to have that you've got the opportunity to grab that. I mean, I would always encourage people to do it because I think it's great fun.
Do you think maybe there needs to be a few more eyes on Master Swimming, a few people watching it? Or do you think that almost defeats the objective of Master Swimming? Because all of what you've just said is you haven't got eyes on you. It's fun on you. Do you think it doesn't need more eyes?
No, I don't. I think, to my mind, I think by this time, I think it's an interesting one because, you know, having sort of done both ends of it, I think it's a really interesting question. I think, you know, certainly from my perspective, and I think from many of those that swim at Masters, it's a very personal thing. You know, they are doing it for themselves. I mean, I often think this is that, you know, we have squad training at quarter to six in the morning. Who in their right mind gets up at quarter past five in the morning to do a swimming session? You know, it's like when you're an elite or you're a senior competitive, you know, you're in, you know, the proper squad, as it were. You kind of understand that, but when you get to 55, like me, I wake up somewhere. What are you doing? but I think it's a really personal thing, and I don't do it because other people are watching me. I don't do it because I want other people to watch me. I'm doing it for me. I'm not so sure it would make any difference. Outside of the fact, I think it is, you know, we have one of the most inactive populations in the world in this country. And I think there would be a value in actually showing that population what can be done. Mm. You know, this belief that once you get past 50, it's all over, you're on the scrap heap and you're never, you know, you can't do anything. Listen, watch some of those. Some of the times I watched was truly phenomenal.
I mean, CJ Nasher. Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the eyes on might be a value, but I think for most of the swimmers' perspective, actually, it's a really personal thing, and I don't think it would change it.
Yeah. Greg, before we kind of wrap things up on this podcast, there's kind of one more topic I want to talk about, and it's coaching celebrities. What sort of challenge does that present compared to normal training, a normal swimming environment? Me and Dan training, what's the difference in coaching a celebrity challenge? Because you've coached a lot, like we said at the start of this podcast.
Yeah, it's challenging. Now, do you know what? I think the interesting thing for me is that what we've done in society, like, is this idea that celebrity is somehow a different breed. It's like somehow they are. It's almost like, you know, that they're sort of this mythical
godlike
beast.
Or whatever.
Yeah, you know, and actually, I can tell you, having all the channels I've worked on, all the guys that are mates of mine, they're just normal people. You know, they're just ordinary people. It's not. They're no different to you and I. I think what's interesting about them is, though, that coaching them is an interesting process because I've learned this over time, and I think with David Walliams, when we trained for the channel, was the best articulation of that. And that is that here's a guy who didn't just arrive at stardom. You know, he has worked incredibly hard over many years to get to that point. Who does that remind you of? That's what elite athletes do. You know, you don't see the 5 o'clock in the morning starts, the pouring rain and through the snow and all the work that goes into it. What we see is the end product at the Olympic Games, and you know, if they get to stand the rostrum, we see the end of it. And of course, we miss what's going through, but it's exactly the same for celebrities. You know, they've done their apprenticeship, they've worked incredibly hard, and I think equally as well, they've they're at a high now, but there were plenty of times during that period where they were incredible lows, and so that what they've done is they know what it is to cope with a disappointment. But also to be able to cope, and I think it's a difficult thing to be able to cope with success. Many people fail to be able to do that. So you've got that ability. You've got the fact that they're incredibly hardworking. They are incredibly tenacious. They want it, you know. And if you give them something to achieve, and they want to achieve that, they will give it everything they can to achieve it. And so to some extent, the only real difference between a celebrity and an elite athlete is just where their skill set lies. You know, one happens to be a 100-meter breaststroker, and the other one happens to be a children's author. That's really the only difference. From a sort of personality perspective, I think it's really interesting. They're very, very similar. So from my perspective, it makes my job that little bit easier, because what I haven't got to do is create that. Yeah, I've got to create that drive and that tenacity and that hard work, which is required to achieve these incredible challenges. My job really is just to mold that and redirect it. And then obviously, you know, from a skill perspective, from a tactical, technical, psychological perspective, bring them to a point where they can, number one, take on the challenge and hopefully be successful at it.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that one of the biggest challenges, I suppose, of celebrities must be the media. Obviously, if there's a camera on you, let's say David Walliams in the Thames, there gets a lot of publicity that comes your way. I suppose that's a bit of a challenge in itself.
Oh, my goodness. And what's interesting on these, I mean, I can't tell you the number of times that we've been papsed. You know, it's sort of gone out of common parlance now. But, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, the paparazzi were everywhere. And I remember doing a swimming session with David Walliams. And I remember it distinctly because it was the day my first child was born, and my wife is still yet to forgive me because I was open water swimming with David. But we were up at Dorney Lake. This is in December, so my daughter was born on Christmas Eve.
Oh, wow.
So we're in December in Dorney. Water temperature 7°C, outside temperature was about -3. And we're just doing a training session. Nothing. I mean, it really isn't that exciting. You know, it's just another training session. And we got long lensed. We got papsed. Doing the swim, and then the afternoon, but this was before we sort of went public with the fact that he was attempting to swim the channel, you know, and that afternoon it was, you know, spread all over the news, what's David Walliams doing swimming and blah blah blah. And it's an interesting one, that it's actually there are wonderful benefits to that media exposure and being a celebrity, but equally it's incredibly invasive. And to some extent, what it does is it adds. And I think what's interesting now is actually, you know, talking swimming, in elite swimming now, you know, there is that focus of attention of the media. You know, and you know, obviously, it happens when you go on Strictly Come Dancing, etc. But you know, you're inviting them in, but it does add another layer of complexity to what is an already complex situation.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Greg, one final question. You've done the Thames Challenge. What's next?
Do you know what? Honestly, I think what's interesting about some of these challenges is, and the Thames was one of those, is that the greatest the greatest impact, I would say, was on my mind rather than my body. Mm-hmm. And I think it takes a period of time to sort of decompress from that. And with some challenges I've done in the past, you know, a whole host of different challenges, I'm almost chomping at the bit for the next one. At the moment, I'm just thinking, do you know what, just give me a break. but interesting, we're talking with a friend of mine who does all these challenges with me, who sort of supports me and looks after me and makes sure he does what I do for comic relief, he does for me, sort of thing. But we're talking about doing some more Tillers next year. Which actually I'm really excited about. So it maintains that love of swimming, which I have, but combines it with, it's almost obviously with running, but that sort of adventure piece that comes along with it. And I've never done one before, but we've taken a look at some, And that's I think we're going to focus on that next year and just see how that goes and have some fun with it. And then probably off the back of that, maybe look at some much bigger adventure racing type approaches and see what happens there.
Not resting too much then.
Blimey.
Wow, you know. Hey, listen, I can rest when I'm dead. That's the way I look at it.
Your definition of rest is very different to mine.
Oh. Well, Greg, thank you so much for coming on to this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. It's been a pleasure chatting to you. Honestly, a fascinating challenge. And hopefully there's so much that can come off the back of it, whether it's more water safety, whether it's cleaner waters, everything and everything in between. Yeah.
Well, listen, thanks for having me on, guys. And keep up the good work. I love what you guys do. It's been an absolute pleasure being on. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, like I said at the start, you deserve all the credit and praise in the world when you're raising over 60 million for charity overall. I mean, yeah, hats off to you. So, and good luck for the next one.
Very kind. Thanks, mate.
So that just about rounds up this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on YouTube, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And me and Dan will be back in 1 week's time.
Yeah, we'll catch you on the next one, guys. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Propulsion Swimming Podcast with Scott and Dan. We want to thank you for joining us and invite you to subscribe to the show, as well as checking out the Propulsion Swimming YouTube channel for weekly tutorials and videos to get your swimming fix. We will be back next week. Until then, we'll catch you on the next one.